Thank you, and welcome to today's media teleconference. Hamilton versus Lanning is the second case this year in which the Supreme Court has had the opportunity to determine the meaning of provisions in the 2005 Bankruptcy Code amendments known as the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act, or BAPSIPA. In Lanning, an amendment to Chapter 13 of the Code was at issue. A debtor who files for bankruptcy under Chapter 13 pays a portion of her income to her creditors over a 3 to 5 year plan. If there is an objection to the proposed plan, the debtor must commit all of her projected disposable income to be received over the term of the plan to plan payments. While BAPSIPA defines disposable income for debtors whose income is above the state median, with reference to a means test formula that takes the debtor's income for the 6 months before the bankruptcy petition into account, it does not define the term projected disposable income. The debtor in Lanning had received a one-time payment from her former employer within the 6 month pre-bankruptcy period. As a result, her disposable income, as calculated according to the means test formula, did not reflect her actual ability to pay under a Chapter 13 plan. Yesterday, the Supreme Court held that when a bankruptcy court calculates a debtor's projected disposable income, the court may account for changes in the debtor's income or expenses that are known or virtually certain at the time of conversation. The time of confirmation. Today, we will discuss that holding. Today's program will consist of about 30 minutes of opening commentary by our experts, and then we will take your questions. The speakers on today's teleconference are Kevin Anderson, who is the standing Chapter 13 trustee for the District of Utah in Salt Lake City, where he is currently administering approximately 10,000 cases. He is also president of the National Association of Chapter 13 Trustees. Mr. Anderson has served on a number of national committees regarding Chapter 13 legislation, rules, forms, and policy. We also have Alan Beckett, who is the managing partner at Beckett & Lee, based in Malvern, Pennsylvania, where she specializes in representation of creditors in bankruptcy matters, primarily consumer lenders and debt purchasers. Ms. Beckett is a member of the ABI Board of Directors, and she has written and lectured extensively on consumer collection and bankruptcy practices. We also have Jean Brocker, who is the Roger C. Henderson Professor of Law at the University of Arizona James E. Rogers College of Law. Professor Brocker is an expert in bankruptcy, commercial law, and contracts, and she is a prolific scholar who has written extensively on consumer bankruptcy and on the 2005 amendments to the Bankruptcy Code. We also have Mark DiGiacomo, who is a partner at Mirtha Colina LLP in Boston, where he represents debtors and creditors in cases under Chapters 7, 11, and 13 of the Bankruptcy Code. Mr. DiGiacomo has served on the Boston Trustee Panel since 1995, and he has written 2 books and several articles on bankruptcy issues. I would like to thank our distinguished panel for joining us this afternoon, and I'd like to start the discussion with Jean. Jean, can you talk in more detail about the court's opinion and tell us how the court came to its decision?
Well, this is, as you mentioned, one of the 2 cases this term that deal with issues under the 2005 law, so the new version of the Bankruptcy Code. And this is the first case in the Supreme Court to deal with the so-called means test, which was a big innovation of the 2005 law. Now, maybe just to backtrack a little bit on what the means test is. The means test, most people think of it as applying primarily in Chapter 7 because it does apply there, and it determines whether a debtor is able to get a discharge. Chapter 7 is basically the quick discharge chapter. So the means test determines whether a debtor can get into Chapter 7 and get a discharge there. And the means test is intended to take debtors who have the ability to fund a repayment plan in the other major chapter, Chapter 13, the other major chapter for consumers, and push them out of Chapter 7 and into Chapter 13. So that's one part of the means test. But that wasn't an issue in the Lanning case because this was a Chapter 13 case, What was an issue was the application of the means test in Chapter 13, and that's another perhaps lesser-known aspect of the means test, that is, that debtors, when they file in Chapter 13, how much they're going to have to pay there depends on how much income they have in excess of their expenses. And for all debtors, Chapter 13 picks up the historical six-month look-back period of the means test, that is, how much income you have is the average of what you had over the last 6 months. And then in Chapter 13, for above-median income debtors, it uses the expense list of means testing, and that's certain allowances, not actual expenses, but certain allowances along with secured debt payments. So the Lanning case deals with Chapter 13, and narrowly what it says is if you have a debtor who's had a one-time increase in income that's not going to recur, and that debtor files in Chapter 13, then the bankruptcy court has the discretion to say, we're not going to use the six-month look-back, which doesn't reflect income going forward. We can instead use, the income the debtor has now as the basis for determining what's available to pay creditors.
And interestingly, and you just noted this, that the court ultimately held that the bankruptcy court may account for changes in the debtor's disposable income. Alan, this seems to create some ambiguity, doesn't it?
Well, I think it does, because to a lawyer, the word may is a permissive word, meaning that the court may consider changes to a debtor's income or expenses, but is not required to do so. On the other hand, if you read the opening few paragraphs of the opinion, it states the forward-looking approach is correct, which seems to be a clear directive that a court should look forward when calculating projected disposable income. So we do have a little bit of a conflict. Had the Supreme Court used the word must instead of may, then their intention would have been clearer. Now, this inconsistency raises a concern to me that the door may have been left open for bankruptcy courts to decline to account for changes in the debtor's income or expenses when determining projected disposable income, because the holding seems to merely allow but not require them to do so. Also, Justice Scalia in his dissent had pointed out that while the majority is allowing for adjustments based on changes that are known or virtually certain, its boundaries, meaning the boundaries in the majority opinion, present yet another non-statutory limit on these changes. And Justice Scalia said that even if the word projected did allow a court to consider other data, there would be no basis for the restrictions that the court reads into it regarding what extent a court must do so. And Scalia said if the statute authorizes estimations, it authorizes them in every case, and not just those cases where changes to the debtor's income are significant and either known or virtually certain. So all of that being said, I'm sure that there will be litigation over proposed changes to a debtor's disposable income in regard to how certain is virtually certain and the amount of a change that is necessary before a court can consider changing the debtor's disposable income.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And Kevin, did you have anything to add on that, on the appropriate standard to deviate from the disposable income calculation from the means test?
Well, not surprisingly, this is the topic I've received the most phone calls on, both from debtors' counsel, creditors' counsel, and other trustees. And that is, what is the standard, or what is the basis, under what circumstances can a court deviate from the required turn under the B-22C. The BAP and the Tenth Circuit decision provided that the Form 22C, or the means test, creates a presumptive return to unsecured creditors that can be rebutted by evidence and explanation showing a substantial change in circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fortunately in a Tenth Circuit district, and this created a very predictable procedural framework, as well as a evidentiary standard as to how one overcomes the presumptive return, whether that's a debtor using the Lanning argument defensively or a trustee or creditor using the Lanning argument offensively, meaning to increase the return to unsecured creditors. Also became fairly predictable, but the Supreme Court went on to simply say the court, as we've discussed, may account for changes in income expenses that are known or virtually certain at the time of confirmation.
Right.
So the problem is the 10th Circuit talked about substantial changes in circumstances. They also talked about special circumstances. Scalia's dissent seems to state the test more clearly than does the actual opinion. He says the formula should not apply in exceptional cases.
Mm-hmm.
Where known or virtually certain changes have occurred. So the issue is, do the changes need to be substantial, exceptional, special, or simply known or virtually certain?
Gives a lot more opportunity for interpretation. Gene, do you have any additional thoughts on the ambiguities in the court's holding?
Yeah, I mean, I think the point that was made about there is some very broad language at the beginning that says the court is adopting a forward-looking approach,
mm-hmm.
arguably even leads to saying you don't need a change, because the means testing expenses are not actual expenses. And what if you have a deviation between what the debtor is saying are my expenses and the expenses allowed, you know, under the means test, do those get taken into account under a forward-looking approach? Or is the holding, you know, more limited? I mean, there's an old-fashioned idea that a court can only hold based on the facts of the particular case before it, you know, that that's the nature of judicial decision-making, and anything else it says is actually not binding on lower courts. So since this case only involved a significant change in income, you could say that's all the court really decided. But it certainly tries to say that it's making a holding on expenses, even though expenses weren't an issue in the case. And then it uses this very broad language about a forward-looking approach, which I would expect some courts will, you know, grab onto and run with. So I think there's a huge amount of uncertainty after this case about exactly what implications it will have in the bankruptcy court.
Well, sure, because there are so many cases out there right now dealing with the expense calculation under the means test,
mm-hmm.
and I found that language in the Supreme Court's opinion a little bit surprising. I'd like to turn for a couple of minutes, and we will circle back to policy, but I'd like to talk for a couple of minutes about the effect that this decision will have on consumer bankruptcy practice today. And Mark, I'd like to start with you on this. Does this decision just bring us back to pre-BAP-CEPA practice, and what was that practice?
Well, I think it brings us, it's close, but not all the way back to that practice. The pre-BAP-CEPA practice, what generally happened was courts would look at the debtor's current monthly income at the time of the bankruptcy, what is their income? Look at how many months the plan is. Is it a 36-month plan, or is it a 5-year plan, or somewhere in between? And just multiply that current income times the amounts of the months. And then also, so that'd be the first step, and then adjust if there are any foreseeable changes in that income up or down. Now, what the court has told us, courts, the bankruptcy courts are supposed to do, is start with the six-month average, the 6 months just prior to the bankruptcy filing. So instead of what the income is as of the filing, look at the 6 months. And then after looking at that, fill in the word, extraordinary or special cases, then the court may, as we talked about, adjust for, quote, known or virtually certain changes. So it's very similar, and perhaps the biggest change is instead of starting like we did in pre-BAP-CPA, with the month, you know, right before the bankruptcy, the current income, we now do need to start with the average for the 6 months. But in both cases, we'll then take a look and see if that reflects reality, which is, I think, really what this opinion is trying to get at, is what is the reality on the ground as far as the income. So I think that's what happened before, and I think that's what the court's trying to do here.
Now, just to follow up, do you think that this decision, Mark, will result in a longer confirmation process so that changes in the debtor's projected disposable income can be determined?
Well, I think what the court, it's possible. I think what the court is trying to do, which I think is the goal here, is to get it right. Let's not, as much as we can, play with numbers that aren't real. In this particular case, it was before the court, everyone agreed that if you applied the mechanical rule, this woman would have had to pay an amount every month into her plan that she just didn't have. She just couldn't do it. So let's try to get to a real number, which is, in fact, the excess or between the income and the expenses, and get that number paid into the plan. So the creditors are getting the maximum amount, but it's a real number. So I can see, you know, you have a debtor coming in at a 341 meeting, and the 13 trustee asks her what's going on her employment. Well, she's employed now, but she hears there are rumors that there's going to be a big layoff, and, you know, Black Friday is next week. So should we go forward to confirmation, or should we wait and see? Is she going to be laid off? The opposite end is the debtor comes in at 341 meeting, is unemployed at the time. But questioning indicates that, you know, next week she's going in for her second interview at a good job, and she's really optimistic. Shouldn't we wait and put off confirmation and find out what's going to happen to this debtor so that we can arrive at the correct amount that gets creditors the most and is something that the debtor can afford? Because that's what this is all about, I think.
Sure. And actually, that's a good segue to the question I want to ask Kevin. I'd like to get the Chapter 13 trustee perspective on how this opinion might change your practice. How do you think Chapter 13 trustees will now administer cases in light of this opinion?
Well, fortunately, we've been following this practice for a number of years since my chief judge drafted the Lanning opinion in the bankruptcy appellate panel. Mm-hmm. And I can say that it's worked very well as we've established procedures. First of all, it's important to understand that the disposable income test doesn't even apply to the debtor unless a trustee or a unsecured creditor objects. And so the trustee has to make the decision whether he's going to object to the issue or not, and then bootstrap in the disposable income test. After the trustee files the objection in our district, the debtor files a response indicating that he is going to argue that Lanning applies and there's been a substantial change in circumstances and that the return to creditors needs to be adjusted accordingly. And the response needs to contain the factual allegations in support of that, as well as any documentary evidence to support that. And in the real world, if you will, the most common type of evidence we see is very plain and straightforward and easy to interpret. It's a copy of the debtor's payment advices showing they've either changed jobs or their income has reduced, or copy of expenses, ongoing expenses, and the amount of those, and that they're greater than what the debtor's expenses were pre-petition. And as a result, those issues are then raised and ripe for the court to rule on in connection with the confirmation hearing. And in a sense, I think it's more efficient than the Kagan-Biyama approach, which was you confirm a case based strictly on the B-22, and then anyone could come back in at a subsequent time, and you don't know if that was a day later, a week later, a month, a year, Kagan Biama, you essentially had to have two hearings. I think under this approach, we'll be able to resolve most of these issues with a single hearing or perhaps a continued hearing. But as far as efficiency, I think it's worked very well in this district.
Okay, that's very useful. Thanks. I'd like to turn for a moment to back to Mark and ask what impact you think this holding will have on debtors. I mean, at first, the decision does seem to be pro-debtor, especially because, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, the debtor in this case simply didn't have the money to pay under a mechanical rule. Is this really a pro-debtor opinion, or is it a pro-creditor opinion, or is it neither?
I think it's a pro-bankruptcy system opinion, really. Because, as you say, in this particular case, the facts we had here was it was a debtor who was not going to be able to take advantage of a Chapter 13 and probably wasn't going to be able to be in a Chapter 7 either. But because of the court's ruling, we'll now be able to go through the 13. But what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Change the facts a little. You have a debtor now who was unemployed for the five of the 6 months prior to the bankruptcy, but the last month, or maybe it was the first month, got a good job. Let's say the last month. So first five, unemployed. Last month, all of a sudden has a job and is making some money. Now, if you just use the mechanical rule, then that debtor is going to be paying a lot less than he should be paying into his plan because he now has a good job. So I think creditors can turn around and assert that the calculation has to take into consideration the facts as they are and that the calculation should be based on the income that the debtor had during that 6 month, because now he's working and presumably going to be working in the future. So again, it's good, I think, for both. It's good for the system, because what it does is tries to get us to a real number, a number that that I think everyone envisions should be paid under the Chapter 13, into the Chapter 13 plan, or at least as close as we can get.
Right, thanks. Alan, I want to turn to you for a moment. What about creditors? Will creditors' practices in bankruptcy cases change in light of this decision?
That's hard for me to say because most creditors didn't really, unsecured creditors at least, who are the ones who will benefit from this, didn't litigate these issues, but rather they left it up to the few creditors who did, or they expected the Chapter 13 trustee to take the issues up for them, some of whom did and some didn't. For my clients, the unsecured creditors, their primary concern is how this case will affect the recoveries that they can expect to see from Chapter 13 cases. In some creditors, though, have advocated for Ms. Lanning's position in this case, that is, that the debtor's actual financial circumstances should be considered when determining projected disposable income. And this is because they recognize that there's no point in forcing a debtor to pay an amount that the debtor is unable to pay, in which case the debtor is going to be dismissed, most likely, but also that it's unfair to allow a debtor to pay less than she can afford merely because a formula came up with a lower amount. So those creditors advocated for the decision that was reached by the Supreme Court. Overall, though, I think all creditors will be happy that the issue is settled, sort of, maybe, because there has been a substantial amount of litigation in Chapter 13 cases since FAPSIPA over this issue, and the issue of expenses, which is the subject of the ransom case, which the Supreme Court has accepted. Creditors like recovering money through bankruptcy, but they also like predictability. This decision, and hopefully the decision in ransom, will give creditors some measure of uniformity on how their bankruptcies will be handled. But as we know, courts can be pretty creative, so how this decision is actually implemented, I guess, is something that we'll have to wait and see. But overall, I agree with Mark that this is a good case for everyone. It helps debtors stay in bankruptcy, helps them get confirmed plans, but it prevents them from being able to shield money from creditors just because of anomalies with the means test formula.
Right. That's a very good point. And I'm glad you mentioned ransom, and we're going to talk about that briefly at the end of this teleconference. And before I get to
Julia,
the...
could I? This is Dean Brouker. Just on this point about who this is good for and who this is bad for, a couple of things I'd like to add. I mean, I think with a bad employment picture that we have now, we have a lot of people losing income, and so for those who might want to file in Chapter 13, maybe they're losing income, they're having difficulty paying their mortgage, they get behind on their mortgage, they want to use Chapter 13, it could be good for those debtors that they don't have to wait, you know, until their income over 6 months is in line with what they have now. You know, they don't have to wait out the period when they had some higher income. So it'll be good. Clearly, it'll be good for some debtors. But I think the opposing kind of view of this is that means testing has this very elaborate mechanical formula that every single debtor in 7 or 13 has to worry about. Everybody has to file their calculation. And now what we're starting to see is, well, first we have this layer of the mechanical review, and then we have another layer of discretionary review with a lot of uncertainty about how that will be applied. And so I think the concern is that this is going to increase the expense of bankruptcy cases, and particularly of Chapter 13 cases. And the filings in Chapter 13 have been declining. So it may be that this is actually going to contribute to that phenomenon. A few years ago, we had over 40% in Chapter 13. We're now under 30% in Chapter 13. And if this contributes to the expense because of the uncertainty, I think we can see that number going down further, that percentage.
Yeah, excellent point. And does anybody else have anything to add on who this is good for and who it might not be good for? Okay, because actually I'd like to use your comment, Gene, to go to a question about Justice Alito's reasoning in this case. One of the things that I found interesting about the opinion is that Justice Alito applied the canon of statutory construction that a court should not read the code to erode past bankruptcy practice absent a clear indication that Congress intended such a departure. And pre-BAP SEPA judges had some discretion in determining projected disposable income. As you just pointed out, Gene, the means test imposed some very strict mechanical formulas on debtors, and so, you know, it seems that BAP SEPA was intended in part exactly to remove judicial discretion. Now, Gene, you have written several articles in which you've urged courts to interpret BAP SEPA in light of the law's purposes and policies. Did the court really do that here?
Well, I mean, it did in the sense of I think there was a concern, and it's an expressed concern by Justice Alito, that that in situations where the debtor has an increase in income or a decrease in expenses and has an ability to pay more to creditors, that the mechanical approach wouldn't capture that. So it's contributing to the extent you think the policy was to get debtors to pay more. I think overall it's going in that direction. Now, what's very interesting about the methodology in the case is that you have a debate going on between Justice Alito and Justice Scalia, who most people think of as both being sort of strict textualists, just read the statute. And I think what we're seeing here is that Justice Alito, and for that matter Justice Thomas, who's also associated with that point of view, are going much more toward a sort of result-oriented approach. I mean, they talk very explicitly about being concerned about the results of their interpretation. And this drives Justice Scalia, into a frenzy, you know, that he says this is exactly when we should just be reading the statute, you know, that it's not clear what Congress was trying to do. Let's just play it straight and not try to fix the system. But I think what you see is that the Supreme Court is basically stepping in to try to fix the mess that Congress created with the 2005 law.
Sure. Thanks. Kevin, what are some of the Chapter 13 payment issues that remain unresolved after Lanning?
Well, one of the primary issues that we'd hope would have been addressed was the real meaning of the applicable commitment period, which is if a debtor's below the median, it's 36 months, above the median, it's 60 months. And on its face, that would seem fairly obvious that below median debtors stay in the case 36 months and above stay in 60 months. But that's not how it's really been interpreted with, for example, the Kagan-Viama decision out of the Ninth Circuit holding that if the disposable income as calculated on the means test is zero or negative, there is no required time limit for the debtor to remain in the case. And indeed, there are cases where in the Ninth Circuit where debtors file for 12 months, pay their attorney's fees, and receive their discharge. I think another example is if the Form 22C shows $1 in monthly disposable income, does that mean the creditors are limited to receiving $60, i.e. the $1 times 60 months, even though the plan will complete in less than 60 months? Or what if it completes in less than 36 months? I think, though, if one interprets this decision, which I do, to hold that the intent of BAP-CEPA was to maximize the return to unsecured creditors, then I think the logical corollary of that is that plans should run, debtors, below median debtors need to be in a minimum of 36 months, above median debtors need to be in 60 months. Another issue that I think will need to be resolved is what happens when you know the change is coming in the future rather than existing at the time of the confirmation. And this is a very common example. A debtor has a known expense, paying off a vehicle, repaying a 401k loan, et cetera, that you know, let's say in month 12 of the plan, will cease. And there has been arguments that does the debtor need to then increase the plan payment by the amount of that vehicle payment or 401k payment starting in month 13. And the court cited to the Nolan case, which did hold that a debtor was required to increase the payment to creditors upon termination of a permissible expense. So I think that's a logical conclusion, that as expenses drop off, the payment to creditors needs to increase. But again, the flip side is if expenses increase, can the debtor come back in and reduce that? And finally, this is a bit of a precursor to ransom, but this issue, if a debtor, and this is a hot topic, what if a debtor is surrendering collateral through the plan or cramming collateral down, and so that the monthly payment either to that creditor either goes away or is substantially reduced? Again, based on the logic of this decision, I think the outcome will be that that is a known or virtually certain change in the debtor's circumstances that will need to be accounted for in determining the appropriate repayment to unsecured creditors.
Yeah, well, that's actually a great segue to the next question and the last question that I have prepared before we take questions from the people listening in on the call. As several of you have noted, in the fall, the Supreme Court will hear Ransom versus MBNA, which is another consumer case in which the means test formula is at issue. In that case, the court will decide whether a debtor can deduct from disposable income ownership expenses for a car when he, in fact, has no car payment. And Kevin, you sort of hinted at what insight the Lanning opinion gives us on how the court might rule in Ransom, and I'm interested in what the thoughts of our other panelists are, and I'll start with Jean. Does the Lanning opinion give us any insight on what the court might do in Ransom?
Well, I think we have to note that Ransom is different from Lanning because it doesn't involve a change in circumstances.
Right.
So you don't have that kind of initial trigger that at least the narrower analysis of Lanning requires, that you need a change in either income or expenses. Here you just have a debtor who owns a car outright and therefore is not making a payment, you know, a monthly payment on a loan or a lease. Does that debtor get the allowance that's given under means testing for home ownership. You know, no change, but it's a case of deviation between the means testing allowance and what shows up on the schedules of the debtor. And, you know, if we start going there, one of the things about if the ransom case comes out that that adjustment is going to be made, you know, there's a U.S. trustee program study showing that 80% of above median income debtors show lower expenses in their schedules than under the means test. But the so-called get tough means test is actually a get easy test in terms of the budgets the debtors put themselves on. So it would lead to a wholesale rewriting of the means test as applied at least to above median income debtors in Chapter 13. So, you know, the ransom case has, in some ways, is a lot more significant.
Sure. Yeah. No, I agree. Alan and Mark, do you have any thoughts on what this opinion might preview for ransom?
Well, Mark, I think that's true. I mean, if ransom comes out that if you don't own a car, I mean, if you don't have car expenses, then you're not entitled to use that expense, then what happens to the whole damn means test?
Right.
I mean, you know, it's out the window then. If that's supposed to be the strict, you know, there's no deviation, here it is, but if we have one deviation, they're going to be able to deviate from everything. On the other hand, such a ruling, putting aside what the law is, would be going in the same direction as I think the Lanning case is, which is, let's deal with the reality on the ground. You don't have a car payment, so that money should be going to your creditors. So that would seem to be consistent with the result-orientated decision that we have in Lanning. But I think a lot harder to get to. In Lanning, the majority, there were some comments earlier about the plain meaning and so forth. I think while the majority knew where they wanted to end up, they wanted to end up in the real world to get this to work, they argued that they could get there through a plain meaning analysis. They argue that this is what we've looked at the plain meaning, and this is what it means. Scalia just says, "I've looked at the plain meaning." Well, they don't use it, but
no.
They go through the analysis, and then Scalia turns around and, as usually happens in these cases, and says, "Well, I'm looking at the plain meaning too, but I'm coming out the other way," which just we could talk about plain meaning and kind of what a joke it is anyway, because usually by the time cases get to the Supreme Court, it's because there's a split in the circuits. So you have circuit courts case, judges who disagree on the plain meaning. So how plain is it, really? But in any event, that's another call.
Well, right. Alan, do you have any closing thoughts on the impact of Lanning?
I do. Interestingly, MBNA opposed the Supreme Court granting cert in the ransom case. MBNA had won all the way up through the Ninth Circuit, where the Ninth Circuit held that the debtor could not expense a car that the debtor owned free and clear. MBNA's argument to the Supreme Court was that Lanning was currently pending before the Supreme Court about to be heard, and that ransom would be decided as a result of whatever decision that came out in Lanning. Despite opposing cert, the Supreme Court took ransom. So that signals me that they don't think that the issue in ransom will be subsumed into the Lanning decision. It signals to me that they think that there's another issue that needs to be decided that wasn't part of projecting disposable income.
Right. Yeah, and I think that, as Jean noted, it has nothing to do with change. It has to do with, although it does have to do with the mechanical application of the means test numbers, so similar but quite different issues. Okay, I'd like to open this up to the audience for questions for our panel. Do we have any questions from the audience?
The question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you would like to ask a question, please do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touch tone telephone. Remember, if you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is off so that your signal will reach our equipment. Once again, please press star, then 1 on your touchtone telephone to ask a question, and we'll pause for one moment. Once again, that is star 1 at this time. We will take our first question from Barbara Young with Golan and Christie.
Good afternoon. My question is, if I have a debtor who is currently working substantial overtime, but recognizes that overtime won't be allowed to continue going into the future, do you think that under this decision, it would be a reasonable thing for me to have the plan, the projected disposable income, be lower, anticipating that change is going to occur and affect the plan payments?
You know, this is Jean Bracker. The Supreme Court opinion actually talks about that example, and it's not a terribly satisfying answer. Talked about a Fifth Circuit, this is in footnote 4 of the case, if you want to take a look, that the Fifth Circuit had declined to require inclusion of overtime pay because it was not definite enough. But then it also goes on to say there may be instances where income obtained through working overtime can and should appropriately be included in the debtor's projected disposable income. So I think they're basically saying how certain is this? It can't be speculative.
Right. I mean,
you know,
I intended to include it, but then not to include it go forward.
This is Kevin Anderson. We actually deal with this scenario all the time, and it's generally fact-specific, but in general, the issue is verifying the reduction or increase in income, and if you want to lower the payments at some future point, our court would require you again to file this declaration that, you know, here's my payment advices for the last 3 months. If you compare those with my payment advices on the filing date, you can see my overtime has decreased. So it's really simply a matter of verifying either the increase or the decrease in a debtor's income.
So your suggestion, just one final question, is that we wait until his overtime declines, then modify the plan, rather than anticipating a decrease in the beginning.
Well, I think if you could project when that would start, you could suggest that in the plan, and month 6, the payment will reduce, and we'll provide verification of that. Otherwise, the payment remains the same. But certainly, any variation on a modification of the plan when the reduction actually occurs.
Great. Thank you very much.
As a reminder, that is star 1 with any questions. And now we'll move on to Katie Porter from the Iowa Law School.
Hi. I have a question about what you make of the role that the United States has taken in each case. On the Lanning case, they supported the debtor's position for forward-looking, I believe. And then Ransom, I don't think they filed a brief yet, but in the Ninth Circuit, I know that they supported the position of MBNA. And I guess I'm curious, what's the United States' interest in these cases? How are they coming up with these positions, and what are we to make of that?
This is Kevin Anderson again. I do have some insight in the background of that. When the law was changed, the U.S. trustee program on a national level met and articulated certain positions that they were going to take on various issues, and they've made those positions known on their website and then in prosecuting certain cases. So actually none of this was really a surprise based on their prior positions, and of course all the trustees don't agree, all the judges don't agree. I'm sure there's no consensus in the community, but at least the official position of the U.S. trustee has been set forth, and that's the basis on which they decide whether to participate or not participate, object, or how they're going to participate in a particular case.
Although, of course, we've had a change of administration since they articulated those principles.
And they do update those. I know they've updated them from time to time, depending on the rulings, and I'm sure if Lanning had gone the other way, that would have impacted their position.
I think you'd have to say the Solicitor General seems to be taking cues from the Executive Office of the U.S. Trustee, which is taking, I mean, the consistency here is that it's a position in favor of unsecured creditors, right? That, and I suppose you could say that's the role of the trustee system, but that this is an odd case where the debtor was seeking the forward-looking approach, and the trustee was saying we should use the mechanical approach, but the...
Well, and NACBA was against the debtor. NACBA was taking the
because in general, debtors would prefer the mechanical approach and the certainty of that. But I think it's an odd case where each side was making the other side's arguments. But I think the consistency here is you get the Solicitor General lining up on the creditor side in both cases.
Yeah, I think this is an unusual situation. Normally, when a trustee is involved, the Solicitor General will come in and support because of the U.S. Trustee's office. So I think it is, you're right to think that this is an unusual situation. And while they have positions and they've been articulated, I don't know if they've figured out every single issue that could possibly come up and taken a position on it. But here it was a little unusual, and I think it would be interesting to know all the background because it feels like the 13 trustee went rogue here.
Well, in the Tenth Circuit, you basically had the Chapter 13 trustee on one side of the case and the Executive Office of the U.S. trustee on the other, and the debtor wasn't represented.
Right. Well, as I said earlier, I was a trustee in the Marama case, which the Supreme Court decided a few years ago, and the Executive Office and the Solicitor General had some very definite ideas about how we should proceed, and clearly let me know that they wanted their views taken very seriously. And they supported me, but, that's usually what we see.
Well, thanks for your insight, everybody, and thanks, Katie, for the question. Any other questions?
And as a final reminder, that is *1 with any questions you may have.
I did have one other point I wanted to bring out in this opinion, if I could, for just a moment.
Absolutely.
And that is, if you were to categorize the two arguments on the two positions, it really boiled down to, did Congress intend BAPSIPA to reduce a judge's discretion or to maintain a judge's discretion? Mm-hmm. And the NACBA came out strongly arguing that BAPSIPA was intended to limit a judge's discretion to produce a more uniform and predictable result. And the Supreme Court rejected that outright. In fact, I think we're very adamant that the bankruptcy court retains discretion. And I think one possible interpretation of that is, we don't want to get involved in the minutiae of a debtor's expenses. Is $300 for cigarettes reasonable and necessary? We have skilled, experienced, intelligent judges on the bench. They should go forth and judge, determining whether the debtor is paying as much as possible based on their actual income.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting observation, particularly in light of the fact that the 2005 law adds the means test, and of course using an elaborate mechanical test seems to go contrary to judicial discretion, but it's not working very well, so then you have judicial discretion overlaid on that, and it really raises the policy question whether we wouldn't be better off going back to the old system prior to the 2005 law, just leave it up to the judges, under substantial abuse in Chapter 7, under, whether you have reasonably necessary expenses in Chapter 13. If we're going to overlay, the means test with that kind of discretion, why don't we just get rid of the means test? Right.
Sounds good to me.
That's a good point.
It's exactly what we should do. But
okay, any other audience questions?
We do have a question from Karen Cordry with National Association of Attorney Generals.
Okay.
Right.
or actually maybe two comments really more than that. One was I actually got an article that was published somewhere, I'm not positive where, but anyway, by the trustee who did the Lanning case, and I just thought it was important to understand that they deliberately picked that case, and they deliberately picked it because they wanted, according to the article, he says that many suggested that Chapter 13 trustees should attempt to obtain circuit-level authority as quickly as possible in order to resolve these cases. So we picked a case where it said messy facts make messy law, so we wanted a case where the facts were clear and simple, and we actually picked facts that appeared to be outrageously anti-debtor, as it appeared conventional wisdom was that the means test was debtor-oriented, so we thought the case would cut both ways and would illustrate it. So there was a method behind the madness of this particular case, and actually it was what my assumption was when it was picked, was that this was one where the Supreme Court took it precisely because this was one where you could see that, you know, taking this particular position wouldn't necessarily be pro-debtor or anti-debtor, just sort of depended on the facts of the case. But I guess my other comment was the suggestion about just going back to the old, you know, no standards at all. I mean, I don't really know what that means, because that just simply means that you have not one means test, but you have 300 means tests, one for every bankruptcy court in the country, and that the same person can walk in front of Judge One and be told that, you know, a $500 house payment is just fine, and the next guy will say, no, it ought to be a $250 house payment. I don't really understand in a situation where apparently uniformity is supposed to have constitutional significance, according to the Supreme Court, that having 300 different means tests is really a very good way of working it. In fact, it seems to me that a structure where you have some kind of basic situation that says this is the norm that ought to work, but if there's, you know, if there are weirdnesses and anomalies that come out, just as the structure between 707B2 and 707B3, that you preserve some discretion for the courts to deal with the unexpected glitches or the guy who's trying to play the system or something like that, that's not, you know, the 707B kind of application of the means test actually seems to be working relatively well, because you do put the judge's discretionary abuse kind of back there as a last thumb on the scale, it seems to me. And I just wonder how the panel would think you'd, if that isn't a sort of approach that if that was really what was said to be done in Chapter 13, whether that would be the best sort of approach there as well.
Well, I suppose you can ask, was the pre-2005 system better than today's system? And then you have your answer.
Well, not in my opinion, because I've read some of those cases.
No, I'm just saying that what I'm talking about is, if you're going to have the discretion on top of the means test, you're getting a very expensive system, and the previous system didn't have the expense of the mechanical before you got to the discretion. Mm. I think the reality is we have local legal culture now, and we had it before, so, you know, the change in the law hasn't ended that.
You asked some excellent questions, and I think that a lot could be said on that. Let me just give my perception based on conversation with judges, is that obviously they were offended if the intent was to take away discretion, too, and I think trustees felt the same way, uncomfortable with a scheme that appeared to minimize the return to unsecured creditors. I agree the means test provides more generous expenses than were allowed in most districts. And so as we've gone through this, I've just looked at the national statistics for Chapter 13, and in fiscal year 2009, over a billion dollars was dispersed to non-priority unsecured creditors. And I think the courts have started to see that the Lanning approach has maintained what I think most people believe was the original intent of Chapter 13, which was to return as much as possible to creditors. So they started taking the Lanning approach. They saw that they were getting, instead of 0% plans, which is what a number of people anticipated, substantial funds were going to unsecured creditors, and that could be attributable in large part to the forward-looking approach to income and expenses.
Okay, well, thank you, everybody. I think now we are out of time, so I would like to thank the panelists once again for their participation and their wonderful insights on yesterday's Lanning opinion, and also thank the audience for their questions.